the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. Like always, I have Dr. Jason Bond with me. And if you listened to our podcast last week, we talked about how it would be great to get Tom Allen on because of weather conditions. We're breeding diseases all around the Delta. Well, we got Tom in here today, and Tom's going to tell us about how those diseases are proliferating.
Hey, you remember last week we were talking about stuff being late?
Yes.
Yeah, Tom was planting beans. We had to wait for him to come do this.
Why?
Well, because like I continue to tell folks, we got to stagger a few things, and we ended up with some minor issues. One, we had autoclave problems. Two, we didn't have inoculum.
Tom, so. If I have to hear about that autoclave problem for one more year.
Nobody even knows what that is.
What is an autoclave, Tom?
An autoclave is a steam sterilizer. That's what they use at hospitals to keep hospital tools clean. So we were going to talk about diseases.
We were going to talk about diseases until...
I'll try to keep us rambling along.
So, Tom, with the weather situation.
Yes.
And all this disease. I saw a tweet you put up the other day, and I think it was northern corn leaf blight.
Sure.
Elaborate.
You're definitely getting... You know, I will be the first to admit.
For once, Tom's a man of few words.
We went through a period there where things were fairly quiet. Yes, man of few words, man of mystery. All right, I'll try to reel us back in. Northern corn leaf blight, fairly common observance this time of the year, especially once corn starts to reach tasseling growth stages.
Yield limiting ability?
In some susceptible hybrids, I suspect you could have some yield limit from that particular disease, but we have limited number of susceptible hybrids to that particular disease. And more often than not, if the temperature would just get warm, typically that those lesions won't expand. They won't proliferate. It's not something that you typically need to make a fungicide application in response to.
So warm is relative.
Yeah.
It is 90 degrees.
How
much hotter?
Warm?
Mid-90s.
Okay. I'll give
mid-90s.
You that.
It's been... Low, or it's been mid to high 80s, let's say,
right,
and
so
rainy.
88 with 130% humidity doesn't count.
No, not really.
Does that make it worse or better?
Makes it a little bit worse.
But
those lesions take a good bit of time for sporulation to occur, new spores to land on leaves, infection to occur, and then the lesion to expand. It doesn't happen overnight.
So that one you showed on Twitter was about as long as your finger.
That'd be about right, 3-4 inches.
What's bad versus, I'm not worried about it. Like, you know, in size.
You got to remember a corn plant's big, and you got to remember there's a lot of leaf surface area on there. So one lesion per plant's not necessarily bad. When you're running across 5, 6, 8 lesions per leaf, that's a lot of surface area covered up. In the years I've been in Mississippi, I've never seen that. And if I have, it's only been one time.
And... ear leaf matter more than any other leaf for when you're looking for this stuff?
If you're at reproductive growth stages, so you're forming an ear on the corn plant, typically what I tell folks when they're scouting corn is disregard everything below your belt buckle once you start setting an ear. Focus on ear leaf and above. That's the part of the plant you need to keep the healthiest. And as you know, Bobby, the further along you get in reproductive growth stages, those bottom leaves on a corn plant get shaded out. They start getting nutrition, starts getting sucked out of that part of the plant. It's just there because it can be.
Yeah, we did a webinar last week, and I told guys specifically focus on the ear leaf or the leaf directly below it, an alternate or the one above. So I think we're tracking in the same direction there for, you know, how we pull nutrition into that ear.
I would agree with that.
So the temperature, Tom, we mentioned that. So with the, not necessarily the temperature, but just the environment we've had since 1st of May, in my world, the residual herbicides have stayed really active, maybe too active in some cases. But so how does that factor into our early season diseases? Because we mentioned earlier, I mean, we do have some, you know, late stuff that's, you know, still fairly small.
Normally, you're not going to end up with infection that occurs on most of that vegetative corn. I've not personally seen northern corn leaf blight on vegetative corn.
Well, I'm not talking about northern corn leaf blight.
You're talking about just anything.
Yeah, just in general.
Well,
in your big soup bowl of diseases that are out in this humid environment. So, for instance, you know, we looked at a little seedling disease on rice last week, and some guy said, you can't have that in June. Well, you did.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. But I think your environment's been strange this year. It stayed cooler longer. We went through periods of wet. It was dry, and now it's wet again.
Okay.
So you've had a prolonged spring-like environment, for lack of a better term, because let's face it, how many of y'all listening to this can sit out there and count the number of 90-plus degree days we've had this year?
Not many.
You get any further along than three or four fingers? I mean, seriously, and those haven't been scorchers. They've been a 92, 93, maybe a 94, and the heat index doesn't necessarily count.
Yeah, I mean, the really hot days we've had have been, you know, in the high 80s with really oppressive humidity.
And I think the hardest part and the thing that concerns me the most is the longer you delay or you prolong the corn crop, let's say that, not delay, but you prolong the corn crop, so you planted your corn a little bit later, you start getting into those windows where things like southern rust tend to become a bigger issue, and it's not so much a northern corn leaf blight, because that particular fungus that causes northern corn leaf blight doesn't like the smoldering hot 95-degree days. You'll get lesion expansion at night when it's in the 70s. Because that's a more conducive temperature for that particular fungus. We have encountered a little bit of southern rust in Mississippi to date, but it's been fields south of I-20, only in Claiborne, which would be the county that Port Gibson's in.
All right, so Tom, you talked us through the leaf blight, and you mentioned rust. I hear you say all the time, southern rust versus what's that other rust? One of them.
Common rust.
One of them's a problem, one of them's not.
Common rust is not a problem, and that's the one I think right now you see a lot in the lower canopy. Again, goes back to some of the leaf tissue issues we just talked about. Common rust, again, we'll tie back into Jason's question about temperature and environment. Common rust likes it cooler and a little bit wetter. So the longer it stays cooler and a little bit wetter this summer, the more we're going to encounter common rust. And that's one that you can find pretty much in any part of the plant canopy, but you typically run across more common rust or more excessive common rust lower in the canopy.
And that's also tied to excessively high nitrogen rates too in some cases.
That particular fungus does tend to follow nitrogen flush in the plant. So as you're pushing nitrogen through a corn plant, you can pick up a good bit more common rust. That's not one to be concerned about. You know, and if you're really splitting hairs, your sporulating pustules are darker in color. They're a little bit more orange. Common rust can also be encountered on the upper leaf surface and the underleaf surface. So top and bottom of the leaf.
So
southern
what?
Rust, you're only going to run across typically,
if it's oranger, it's worse, right?
No. Well, oranger meaning lighter in color?
Now you stumped me, because I thought oranger would be more robust orange.
Let's put it like this, because I'm an Auburn grad, I can say this. More Auburn orange coloration, common rust. More Tennessee orange coloration, that god-awful orange color they got up there for those volunteer uniforms, southern rust.
Point taken.
Vivid.
Sure. Well, it's an easy way to tell that apart.
Jason's from Arkansas, so he would have said the burnt orange longhorn.
That's
color.
Right. Sure. You know, and that fits in there. And I always chastise folks that have a Tennessee pedigree about that situation. But, you know, that's all right. But honestly, the hardest part about that is color of common rust sporulation will differ depending upon where you are in the canopy. Upper part of the canopy, it's really dark in color. Lower part of the canopy, it can be lighter in color. So you can have a tremendous amount of confusion early in the rust part of the season for people to make a diagnosis in the field.
And common rust is not yield limiting.
Correct.
Ergo, it doesn't matter if you're from Auburn or Tennessee, it's not a problem.
Early in the season, that's southern rust can be yield limiting if there's an excessive amount in the field.
So, yeah. Tom, what about cotton? What's going on in the cotton world?
Boy, cotton. Cotton sometimes is a sore topic. Bacterial blight. You know, we have been out looking for this new virus, cotton leaf roll dwarf virus, or CLRDV, and I think a lot of people might give us a hard time about the fact we hadn't found it yet. Well, I think The fact that we hadn't found it means that it's probably not as widespread this early in the season as of yet.
Because you look harder than anybody I know.
I don't know that that's true.
No, that is a fact. You log more miles and look harder than anybody I know. So if you ain't found it, it can't be found.
I have spent a lot of time trying to wrap my head around the appearance of cotton plants right now, and we struggle when you have as high thrips pressure as what we've had early in the season. And being as that is an aphid transmitted virus, and we are starting to pick up some higher aphid numbers, I think it probably will be just a matter of time before we pick up the cotton virus this year. But, you know, that's something we'll continue to look for. But to go back to your question, Jason, a little bit of bacterial blight out there, and certainly earlier in the season than what we typically run across that. I think I had two texts yesterday and today, so it'd be Sunday and Monday, bacterial blight and some knee-high cotton. So that's pre-bloom cotton in those situations. And I picked some up in Stoneville last week that was pre-bloom cotton.
So are y'all inoculating for that, or are you just waiting for that one to show up?
That one shows up on its own.
You just plant the susceptible.
Do we need to go into why that shows up? That is the number one seed-borne organism in our production system.
Well, I mean, I think everybody that's dealt with it knows it.
Yeah, you know, I think so. But when we do...
But I know. I guess I'm asking, I know y'all inoculate...
We do.
...a lot of things. I was just curious if you had an inoculum for that.
We do a variety testing or variety trial program inoculation for that, typically at first bloom, and then go through and evaluate that about 2 to 3 weeks post-inoculation. You know, evaluate it multiple times to kind of come up with good information as to what's susceptible and what's resistant. And the nice thing is the seed companies are certainly providing a tremendous amount of resistant varieties. The hard part is there are still some bacterial blight susceptible varieties available, and that's something that if you want to prevent that particular disease and the potential yield losses associated with it, choose a variety that's not susceptible. And there's a long list of them. That's all in the Mississippi Crop Situation blog. We post that there annually.
All right, so you wanted to talk about cotton, and I want to talk about rice. We'll get to soybeans later. So we're approaching on probably 50% of our acres mid-season. So we're getting around that time we like to talk about blast. And if you look at our acreage being up this year, a lot of that acreage is in conventional varieties that have, let's just say, less than stellar resistance.
I'd agree with that.
What about this weather? Is it, to me, getting up like this morning, Jason said, man, you don't want to go outside today. When I hear Jason say that, it makes me think blast weather.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anything that extends your period of leaf wetness in these what you could consider more mild temperatures can certainly be extremely conducive for that particular disease. And I won't be surprised if the phone starts to ring about that, but you know as well as I do, I mean, the leaf blast thing, I think it raises some eyebrows because then it's difficult to really suggests that there may not necessarily be a correlation between leaf blast and neck blast.
That's correct.
And I think that's something that we need to spend a little bit more time talking about. And of course, you know, I'm realist when it comes to plant pathology. Lots of people don't like that. It's basic biology. It's not something anybody liked in high school or college. So they kind of tend to glaze over when you start talking about those things.
Well, what do you think they felt about chemistry?
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't do so well in chemistry either. I did much better in biology.
You're a biologist.
That's right. Hence, I'm a biologist. I couldn't understand all the math behind basic chemistry, and organic chemistry was just a waste.
So it's usually my cue to bring up the row rice. How's blast going to factor into a furrow irrigated rice system?
I hate to say time will tell, but I think when you're talking about altering your environment in that system, because you're doing exactly what we tell farmers not to do, which is that whole wetting and drying or periods of wet and dry or alternate wetting and drying that occurs in row rice, which could exacerbate that leaf blast situation, especially in an environment like this right now.
And blast is a soil-borne disease, right?
Blast is a soil-borne organism, but it's also wind-borne, so it more than likely gets cooked up probably on an additional host and moves inoculum into those rice fields. You know, and I would say the worst blast situations I've ever seen are somebody that's not doing a good job of maintaining their flood. So how that's going to factor in a row rice system is, I think, something that we have a good bit of educating ourselves to really figure out, A, what that's going to look like, and B, how we need to manage that. The nice thing is we've not planted super susceptible varieties in those systems, but I think how those varieties can deal with the cultural practice, because none of those varieties that we're planting in a row rice system were intended to be planted in a row rice system. They're paddied rice varieties.
What's the status of your sheath blight resistance? I mean, it maybe not your, but just in general in the South.
Well, say Mississippi, because it's yours in Mississippi, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So far, only one location that we have documented strobilurin resistant sheath blight, or strobilurin-resistant Rhizoctonia solani that causes sheath blight. So that's something we're continuing to look into, because I think that's another one of those inevitable situations. We use an awful lot of strobilurin fungicides in rice production systems, and the development of resistance within any fungus can be rapid.
Tom, the resistant sheath blight, obviously that fungus is not unique to rice, so how's that affecting our other crops?
The same fungus that causes sheath blight in rice, Rhizoctonia solani, can also cause aerial blight in soybean. Now, the interesting thing there is one would think it would be much more widespread or more widely observed in the Delta, since we typically do a rice-soybean rotation in the Delta. Aerial blight in soybeans, typically a bigger problem in smaller field situations in the hills or south of I-20. Now, the issue there is that you typically manage aerial blight just like you manage sheath blight with a fungicide that contains a strobilurin or a quinone outside inhibitor fungicide active ingredient.
But I've never heard you talk about aerial web blight a lot in soybeans. Your big deal in soybeans is always frog eye, frog eye, frog eye.
It had been for a few years, yeah. But certainly aerial blight, those guys down in South Mississippi, they were
across. Oh, that's before he moved on to that taproot decline.
The Rhizoctonia, you know, that fungus is in the soil, and we put a seed treatment on basically every acre of anything that we plant. So why haven't we ever seen any resistance in that fungus to those seed treatments? You would think the selection pressure would be greater on it. I just popped into my head, there may not be an answer to that.
I don't know that I can answer that. I mean, that's a very good question. I know that's something that a group from Arkansas had looked into, whether or not you could actually detect fungicide resistance that had developed in any of those soil-borne organisms, and I don't think they were even looking at Rhizoctonia.
Because none of the seed treatments are strobilurins, right? I mean, they're...
No, that's incorrect. There are a tremendous number of seed treatments that are strobilurins.
Okay, I stand correct.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, there are a lot of azoxystrobin-based seed treatments for several reasons. One, that's still a really good active ingredient on seedling-associated diseases caused by Rhizoctonia. And two, also, there are some seed companies and or companies that produce seed treatments in general that will give that the moniker of a plant health benefit.
Got you. So have you seen any frog eye yet in soybeans?
Not seen any frog eye. And I know Bobby brought that up a minute ago, but the bulk of the varieties that we plant in our soybean production system these days tend to be fairly tolerant or resistant to frog eye. So that's definitely a good thing. I mean,
so we accomplished that in a very short time, because it wasn't that long ago that all you were talking about was frog eye.
We did. I mean, there was a big shift there however many years ago when we used to plant.
That when we moved on to this, I can't say dicamba beans, but was that the technology that changed it?
Well, I wouldn't say that technology changed it. I think our breeding programs were on to using some different germplasm at that point in time, and the bulk of that germplasm just tended to be resistant to that particular organism. And really, I wouldn't say we've moved on from that. I think you could factor environment into that too. I mean, we still plant pretty susceptible soybean varieties for our efficacy trials, and we don't end up with a lot of frog eye for whatever reason. In a lot of cases, it's because the environment's just not right.
All right, Tom, I know you're still planting soybeans, so we're going to let you get out of here and get back at it. So we appreciate you pausing that operation and coming and sitting down and talking with us for a little while. But as always, if you need Tom, you know where to find him. He's very accessible. And as always, just give us a call if we can help you do anything.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it. It's good to see you all.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.